From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Today we mark National Crime Victims' Rights Week by hearing firsthand what it's like to have someone in your family murdered. The shock, the grief, the media coverage, and facing the accused in court. We listen back to my conversations from 2009 with Julie Paulson, the aunt of Katie Hill and Molly Edmondson. The two young women were murdered in Cedar Rapids in 2006. And Tammy Stevens. Her sister Shelley, a single mother of three, was killed in Hiawatha in 2003. That encore edition of The Exchange for National Crime Victims' Rights Week follows this news. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer, and you're listening to an archive edition of our program today. This week is National Crime Victims' Rights Week. Rallies, candlelight vigils, and a host of commemorative activities are being held across the country to promote victims' rights and to honor crime victims and those who advocate on their behalf. Among those victims who suffer most are those who have lost a loved one to homicide. Thankfully, there is a service in Iowa that helps these families. Based in Cedar Rapids, the Horizons Survivors Program was created in 1991 to address the needs of families of homicide and vehicular homicide victims. They're commonly known as homicide survivors, or simply survivors. This hour, we want to explore the Survivors Program. The nonprofit organization helps the family members of homicide victims in the immediate aftermath of a homicide and often long after their cases have disappeared from the headlines. Joining me in the studio, B.J. Franklin. She is a victim advocate with the Horizons Survivors Program. B.J., thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us, B.J. has brought along two Iowans who have lost loved ones to homicide. We welcome Julie Paulson. She is the aunt of Katie Hill and Molly Edmondson. The cousins, Katie and Molly, were killed by Kyle Marin at Edmondson's Southwest Cedar Rapids apartment. That was in April of 2006. Marin is now serving a life sentence. Welcome to you, Julie.
Thank you.
Tammy Stevens is the sister of Shelley Razor Markwell. Shelley Razor Markwell, a single mother of three living in Hiawatha, was killed by Christopher Wheeler, and that was in 2003. Tammy, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's begin. We want to talk about a lot of things this hour. Have you talk about your loved ones, the loved ones you lost, what it's like to go through this nightmare, how you coped in the immediate aftermath, and how the long-term healing is going. And then throughout, have BJ talk more about the Survivors Program, and how you can help and intervene in the lives to make it this nightmare a little bit easier. But first, I'd like to have you tell us a little bit about the loved ones you lost. Julie, you lost both Katie and Molly. They were cousins, both your nieces.
Yes.
Tell us about them, Katie and Molly, first of all.
Katie was red hair, freckles, blue, sparkly eyes, a senior at Solon High School, and getting ready to graduate, and set herself out on a who-knows kind of a pattern. She was headed to fashion design school in California, and she had the world at her feet. She just had everything there ready to be taken for her. Just a beautiful, beautiful soul. Sometimes it seemed like she was an older person in a younger body. She seemed to be, she just had a lot of knowledge for being a young girl, but always a smile. She would help anyone out. Molly was just a beautiful young girl who her mom and dad just truly loved. Her grandfather and grandmother loved, and her uncle. working, going to school, trying to reach her dreams also. You know, they were just having their normal young life, and being close friends, they caught up together going to Kirkwood and kind of got that family bond tied a little closer and just did about everything and anything. Katie was more outgoing,
right,
and Molly was a little more reserve, which Katie worked on for her. So they complemented each other very well.
Tell us about the circumstances surrounding their deaths.
We had, it was a early Easter dinner in 2006. We were at our home in Durant, and Katie was coming with her father, Ray, and we were going to have our Easter dinner a little early because Katie was set to go to San Francisco to look out the apartments for her college, for her school. So we were getting together, and Katie wasn't here, and she didn't come, and we knew that she and Molly later that Sunday morning had an appointment to, I believe, go to Yonkers. They were going to sign up and see if they could get some work. So we knew that they had been together the night before. There was a party, a get-together. It's some mutual friends of the girls, and we knew that Katie was going to stay at Molly's apartment. And then we knew that she and Molly were going to go to the job interview, and then as far as we knew, Katie would go ahead and come to Durant. Well, we got through the dinner, and we never heard anything, and her dad was on the phone, and I began calling and leaving voice messages from Aunt Julie and wondering, mm-hmm, what's going on, Katie. Pick up the phone. And couldn't get through, left her voice message. About 4 o'clock in the afternoon, decided to call my cousin, Alan, who is Molly's father, and say, have you heard from Molly? I knew the girls were together, and we're just trying to track Katie down, and I who knows what they're doing. But anyway, I said, I'm just trying to figure out where she's at. I'm kind of concerned. It wasn't like her. She usually responded pretty quick to a call. Well, Alan hadn't heard from Molly either, and so he started calling Molly's cell phone. And so we went ahead, just figured something happened. Who knew? They were just went home and decided not to come to dinner. So my brother-in-law went ahead, left Durant about 5 and decided to go to Molly's apartment just to check and see. He had a gut feeling. As parents, we get that feeling that something's not quite right. And Ray drove to Cedar Rapids, to Kirkwood, to Molly's apartment. And Katie's car was there. And the door was not locked. And Ray had went in and he found the girls.
The father found the
father
girls.
Father of Katie, yeah.
Found the girls.
Yep. Yep. So that's kind of where it all starts to.
And the moment you discovered.
Well,
this.
I thought I'd give Ray about an hour and a half just for the travel. And I contacted him about, I think it was about 6:40 that Sunday night. And I called his cell phone and I said, did you finally find Katie? And he just paused and he said, Julie, Katie's dead. And I said, what? I didn't think I heard him. And he said, I'm at the police station. Katie's been murdered. Molly's been murdered. And our whole lives changed.
So sorry for your loss, Julie.
Thank you. Yeah, it...
All of it changes. All
it just changed. It just changed. Everything changed. Priorities, everything changes.
How do you cope with something like that as a family, the father, the immediate family, in the immediate aftermath? two young, beautiful, intelligent girls with everything going for them, and everything stops. How did you cope? What do you remember of those first few days?
I remember that after talking to my brother-in-law, I immediately got my youngest daughter, who lives in Muscatine, and we drove right to Solon. I just wanted to be there with Ray, thinking that I didn't hear him right. And I just thought that something, I didn't understand what was going on. So I don't even remember driving on the interstate to Solon, but we got there and Ray had came home. And I just looked at him and I could see that the sparkle in his eye was gone. That had always been there. And I knew that I knew that was it.
You know, there was no more denial.
There's just no more. It's in my face. And the next, you know, you just don't know. There's nothing you can say. We just had to be there and support each other. And I, you know, we were there, my daughter and I were there. And I remember talking to Molly's mom and dad and trying to tell them how sorry I was and just trying to
in that first in that first moment when you're confronted with this, how much of a factor, how important is it to know why it happened or what happened?
That's the first question that is in the mind. Why? What could have happened to these two girls that had no enemies? They were two trusting, loving, caring young women who would have helped anyone who asked them. And they obviously befriended Kyle. He was a friend. What went wrong, I have no idea. But,
Julie, we have to take a short break and we'll be right back. Thank you for sharing that with us. Take a break here. Julie Paulson is with us, the aunt of Katie Hill and Molly Edmondson. They were killed by Kyle Marin, who was serving a life sentence in 2006. We're marking National Crime Victims' Rights Week on The Exchange. Also with us, Tammy Stevens, sister of Shelley Razor Markwell, who was killed in 2003. B.J. Franklin, a victim advocate from the Horizon Survivors Program, with us. And we'll continue with our discussion in just a moment. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer, and you're listening to an archive edition of our program today, commemorating National Crime Victims' Rights Week this week. Julie Paulson is with us. She lost her nieces, Katie Hill and Molly Edmondson, in April of 2006. They were killed by Kyle Marin in their Edmondson's southwest Cedar Rapids apartment. Tammy Stevens, also with us. She has her sister, Shelley Razor Markwell, was killed by Christopher Wheeler in 2003. And victim advocate B.J. Franklin is with us. She is with the Horizon Survivors Program. It's a program that was created in 1991 to address the needs of families of homicide and vehicular homicide victims, commonly known as homicide survivors or simply survivors. And we're listening to these cases this hour to raise awareness about this wonderful program that is there when people are experiencing something. It's hard to imagine anything worse or more horrendous than losing a loved one to homicide. Tammy Stevens, you've been sitting next to Julie as she's recounted her story. I wonder if you can tell us, first of all, a little bit about your sister, Shelley. What kind of person she was?
I'd be happy to share my thoughts of Shelley. Shelley was a mother of three beautiful children. Shelly has a gift for of crafts and sharing and creating and painting and doing many things to be a model of creativity for her children, as well as a mother in their life. She often gave us handmade items that we cherish, and for I can't tell you how precious they are. She was a very caring, loving person. She would give you the shirt off her back. If she had three muffins and four people, she would give the three muffins, because that's just who she was. Very kind, very creative, and very loving.
How large is your family? How many siblings were you?
I have an older brother, and then me, and my sister Shelley, and a younger sister Jody.
So she was your younger sister. Tell us about the circumstances in 2003 that led to her murder.
It was in July, and it was a warm day, and we received a phone call on my cell phone saying that Shelley had been murdered and that we should come to Hiawatha. As she had explained before, you don't remember even getting there. My husband and I jumped into the car and drove over there. And
also in disbelief?
Oh, beyond disbelief, and came on to a media circus of people, cars, trucks, police people that, I mean, I would have never even begin to know in my real world. That stuff appears to happen on TV.
And
here you're placed right square in the middle of it with absolutely no idea or ever thought that it would happen to you. And we drove up through the apartments, and there were people stopping people to come in, and we shared our stories that we're family members. And we walked up to the apartment, and there were people blocking the door. And I was looking for my nieces and nephews and to see what was happening. And when you see your family member and you see the pain on their face, there's nothing like that.
And all this time, the media cameras are wanting to get an interview?
Well, actually, the media had a microphone in her 13-year-old son's face, taking his statement. And I couldn't believe it. He had just lost his mother.
Christopher Wheeler is now in prison, life term, for this murder. What do you understand of why this happened? She was strangled.
She was strangled, yes. Shelley had worked with Christopher Wheeler, as I understand it, within maybe a year or two at a local company in Hiawatha. And she knew that he had fallen on some tough times and didn't have a place to stay. And so Shelley, being who she was, the giving person that she was, had him stay with her, not stay with her, but be in their home as a place to sleep. And that was what I believe happened to, she would care for anyone. She would open her heart to anyone. And in this particular case, she opened her heart to someone who murdered her.
Tammy and Julie, tell us how, maybe back to you, Julie, how the Survivors Program then entered your life. Was it immediately after the death of Katie and Molly that the Survivors Program was there? How did you first recognize there was such a thing as a Survivors Program and B.J. Franklin and her colleagues?
The Monday morning, Christy Hamlin, who is just a wonderful woman from the Cedar Rapids Police Department, she came to my brother-in-law and sister's home in Solon. And I believe that Emily came with her. Emily was with the Survivors Program, and she came along with Christy and just wanted to get a little more detail about things and wanted to talk to my brother-in-law. But also Emily and Christy spoke about how they could help. What could they do? Told us what all they had available that we, you know, we had at our, to use any tools. We could talk, we talked about the funeral arrangements, how they could help with that. They were so helpful in the fact that they walked us through what was going to happen the next few days, which we had no idea.
Let me turn to you, BJ, because you know certainly all the services that are offered by the Survivors Program here. This is something that is just a part of your work. Nonetheless, it's hard for the rest of us to imagine. You get a phone call like this, a new case opens, a dreadful call, and to help a family of a survivor. Go into to what you do when you're called to action to help these people. What are your first priorities? Go from there.
Usually when we get called, it's in the middle of the night, and it's usually by law enforcement. The Division of Criminal Investigation is usually who contacts us. And so they will contact us and say, usually they start out with, "Hey, BJ, you sleeping?" And I usually was. And then they'll start out by saying, "I have such and such a case. This just has occurred." And usually at that point, what I'm trying to do is get information in regards to, you know, who was the victim, how many family members are involved, have they had any contact with the family, so that I can find out how the family's being notified in regards to the death, because that sticks with family forever. How they're told. I mean, if you talk to any survivor, they can tell you the exact moment. They can tell you the words. They can tell you anything that is possible surrounding their notification of the family member's murder.
Why is that? And Julie and Tammy, please jump in here. Why is it important, the death notification, the moment you find out, the manner in which that happens? Can you share anything about that? Tammy?
Yeah, my nephew actually was one who had contacted. And again, the phone, as we were in transport, the phone is ringing and, you know, one after another. And he said, you know, that my mom is dead. And I'm like, we're on our way there. And what can we do? I mean, the whole circumstance when you hear it is
from a child
is just like it's really not happening. You can't absorb it, and you come on to a scene that I just felt completely like I didn't know I would ever be part of this, part of the world, part of the reality of that moment in time. And it changes you forever.
We have to take another short break, and then we'll come back in a few minutes to talk to Julie Paulson and Tammy Stevens. Also with victim advocate BJ Franklin. She's with the Horizon Survivors Program based in Cedar Rapids, a program that helps survivors of homicide deal with many, many facets. And back with The Exchange in just a few moments. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer, and you're listening to an archive edition of our program today. And we're marking National Crime Victims' Rights Week this week. All across the nation, rallies, candlelight vigils, a host of commemorative activities are being held to promote victims' rights and to honor crime victims and those who advocate on their behalf. And we are talking about the Horizons Survivors Program this hour. It was created in 1991 to address the needs of families of homicide and vehicular homicide victims. It's based in Cedar Rapids, and they serve what are commonly known as homicide survivors or simply survivors. So we're talking with BJ Franklin. She is a victim advocate with the Horizon Survivors Program. Joining us also, Julie Paulson, the aunt of Katie Hill and Molly Edmondson. They were killed by Kyle Marin in Cedar Rapids apartments in 2006.
Tammy Stevens has been telling us her story, the story of her loss. Her sister, Shelley Razor Markwell, was killed in 2003 by Christopher Wheeler. And we're continuing to talk about these stories and how, in these dire circumstances, the Survivors Program aids in whatever way it can. Let's talk. I want to turn to you, BJ, as the victim's advocate with the Survivors Program. Give us a quick rundown of the length and breadth of the services offered by the Survivors Program. I was surprised in looking at the list of things that happened from the beginning to the end, ongoing throughout lives. You really do cover a broad spectrum.
We really do. And I think that the what happens is recognizing that most of the family members that we deal with have never been involved in a court proceeding, obviously have never been involved in a murder case, haven't ever had media following them when they get into vehicles or putting microphones in their faces. And so part of what we're trying to do is just educate them and assist them and support them in, you're going to deal with this. This is what's going to happen next. This is where we're going to go with this. And just kind of trying to give them a little bit more direction and choice and control. Murder is the ultimate way of taking away someone's control and options. And what we want to do as a program is try to give them back some of that control and give them back some options. And we do that by educating them and preparing them for what they're going to see and what they're going to hear and what they may end up experiencing. Everybody deals with grief differently. Everybody's circumstance is unique. And some of that is just letting them know that however they feel, whatever they are experiencing is a normal reaction to an abnormal situation.
Okay, so it goes from dealing with the grief, also with the media, also with the criminal justice system, someone who's perhaps never worked within it. How do you find your way around it, in it, work within it while in the midst of this unimaginable grief? Tammy, you referred in our first half hour to the media circus, I think you said, that on the day that your sister was killed in 2003, when you showed up at the home. What sticks out at you that you wish hadn't happened when it concerns the media on that day?
Well, the sensitivity of the whole moment is huge in your heart, as it's your family member, as it's your loved one. And my immediate thought was, you know, Shelley's not there to protect her children. Where are her children? Who, you know, just to try to do an instant assessment of family and who's where and is everybody okay? And it takes you, it just inundates your thoughts of how you could be in this moment, in this time, from, you know, going to the market to receiving that phone call that says that your loved one's been murdered.
And I understand that your sister was found, her body was found by her 12-year-old daughter.
That's correct.
What do you do, BJ, in that case, when you have children, three children of this mother who die? What is the first most important thing to do? Obviously, years of counseling will have to follow.
Really, it's a matter of finding out what they need at that moment. It may be something. Part of what I've done when I'm very first involved in a case that has children is I will talk with the kids in regards to what they need, because most of the time the crime scene is probably their home. And so what I may do is work out with law enforcement and say, look, I need to be able to go and get their favorite stuffed animal off their bed, or I need to go and grab a laundry basket and fill it with some clothes, or they are all nervous. Depending upon their age, you know, they may be all nervous because they don't have their school papers. And so I may
have to... That was the case with you, Tammy. You're shaking your head.
Right. One of the things that the murder investigation required is that they confiscate my sister's computer, which would be the vehicle by which my niece and nephew did their schoolwork. So everything that they did for their daily life was confiscated. and the survivors group worked through to get them a new computer so they could continue on what they need to do to start that process of the moment after this has occurred.
Tammy recounted how, you know, microphones were stuck in her face, some family members' faces. BJ, what are some of the worst sort of bad behavior examples that you've encountered in part of the media operating on a murder scene? Or in reports?
Wow.
Maybe just one instance or two instances.
I think that, you know, I think prior to doing this job, I had never dealt with the media. So it was a learning curve for me also. And I cannot quite describe the feeling when somebody puts a microphone in your face and asks you to talk. And what I tell people is, picture the worst day of your life and having somebody at that moment put a microphone in front of you or turn a TV camera into your face and ask you to recount what, you know, how do you feel about that? Mm-hmm. And it's just, it boggles the mind.
And also that the, isn't it a fact that also you are consuming the media as the rest of us are, family members. So there can be very disturbing ways in which this is portrayed in the newspaper, on the radio, or in television. Yes, Julie, did that happen to you?
Well, for the girls, the media, I felt truly that overall they were very sensitive to the situation. There were a few that were very persistent and wanted to get personal interviews, which BJ and the Survivors Program, you know, said it's completely up to you, but, you know, just be aware that it was still fresh. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you just, they're going to take maybe, they won't twist it.
Ben,
I think one of the situations that the Survivors Program has run into with the media with new cases, and it was very present with Katie and Molly's situation, is that the media has been putting copies of the arrest warrants or search warrants on the internet, and they put them in detail. And in Molly and Katie's case, there were multiple murder weapons used. There were a number of bloodied articles that were taken from the crime scene and different things. And all of that was a part of the law enforcement's arrest warrant and search warrant. And so part of our goal was to try to get a hold of family before they saw it all on the internet.
Do you tell them to, can you tell them to stop consuming media?
Is that what you do, Julie?
Well,
you need to do, because you know, you might see something that just shocks you so much.
Well, BJ will, she told us numerous times, you know, this is going to be brought out there, and I want you to be prepared.
Graphic details about the death.
Graphic, very graphic. Mm-hmm. And you think you're okay with that, but you're not. And you certainly can't imagine someone not knowing the girls or knowing the situation. How in the world do they interpret this?
Right.
Tammy?
And it almost feels like an instant judgment without the facts. One of the things that is very close to me is one of our local radio station or one of our local television stations in Cedar Rapids was running a clip on their TV news, and they would lead in between the breaks from programming talking about their news coverage, and there would be the anchor outside of my sister's apartment talking about it over and over. And this would come in on a 7 p.m. show. It would come in on a 8 a.m. cartoon. And it was the local station promoting their news, which we all watch at 5 and 6 o'clock each night, maybe 10. But the perception when they're talking about your family member, I found to be just vacant. To them, it was news. To you, it was your loved one. And so I seen it twice in a matter of maybe 3 hours, and called the radio station or called the television station, spoke to the general manager and said, what are you doing? You know, my niece and nephew and my family members are seeing this. Where's your responsibility here? They're living it every moment, and you are contributing.
And the reaction from the TV station was?
The reaction once that they heard this was, oh my gosh, I will get back to you. Let me see what I can do. And within 20 minutes, the general manager called me back and that spot was removed. But had I not made that call, this would have gone on over and over, just to them as a advertisement for what they do. But to us, it was...
It's headlines, and it sells newspaper.
Selling a product.
But it's just,
yes.
I want to remind our listeners that we're marking National Crime Victims Rights Week by talking to Julie Paulson. You just heard her, along with Tammy Stevens. Julie Paulson is the aunt of Katie Hill and Molly Edmondson. She lost these nieces in 2006. They were murdered in 2006. Tammy Stevens lost her sister, Shelley Razor Markwell, in 2003 when she was murdered. Also with us, B.J. Franklin, a victim advocate with the Horizons Survivors Program, helping in many areas, not only dealing with the media coverage that surrounds a murder, but I want to talk for a few minutes because the hour is getting away from us. Talk about counseling for survivors. We haven't talked about much about that. I want to talk about how the grief process, the grief that you feel in the case of a loved one dying at the hands of another person is different than someone dying in an automobile accident, by accident, or someone dying of cancer. How is the grief different? What can we say about that?
There's anger.
Julie?
There's anger. And honestly, here I am 3 years later, and I can say that I still have anger.
Toward the murderer, in this case, Kyle Marin,
yes,
who is serving a life sentence.
Yes.
The hardest part is that I think the hardest part for grieving with homicide cases, whether it's vehicular homicide or a different type of homicide, is that it was seen as preventable. It was somebody's choice to do this to another individual. And because of that choice, you've lost something that can't ever be replaced. And your entire life has been changed from that moment on. And that piece, that preventable piece, makes the grieving so much more difficult than a natural death or a death due to an illness. I mean, people still have those same types of feelings in regards to loss and sadness and anger at the disease, but it's very different when there's a person that you know made this choice to do this thing.
Tammy, you had to give a victim's impact statement in court before the conviction of Christopher Wheeler, who killed your sister. That is tied in with the grieving that you had, because you had this man before you who, as BJ said, is responsible for the death of your sister.
That's correct. And writing a victim impact statement is probably one of the furthest things from something that I ever thought I would do in my entire world. Going into the occurrence, and when you say it takes a village, you have the police that were supportive. You have Emily, BJ, you have Tony, the victim's coordinator there. You have people that just help you through that. And actually, when I wrote the victim's impact statement, I wasn't sure that I would be able to do it. Tony Litke helped me do that. And she said, I will stand behind you there and help be support for you. So as I read that statement, I looked across the courtroom, and the person that had taken my sister from me had a smirk on his face. He had a smirk on his face, not just while I was reading it, but when people were testifying, as well as my niece, my nephew. For some reason, he felt the need to make it appear that he was smirking. I'm not sure how to describe that. I guess I'm not able to bring to words. But when I recall myself sitting on that stand, reading that statement, looking over at him, I wasn't going to give him the satisfaction of acknowledging his smirk, but it was extremely uncomfortable, and I was in a place that I never thought I would ever be.
We hear about something called, it goes by restorative justice or the victim-offender dialogue. In some cases, it seems to be helpful to survivors to meet the perpetrator, the murderer. Would that ever come into consideration for either you, Julie, or Tammy?
No.
Can you imagine how that might be healing at all?
No. I've been asked if I have or if I'm able to forgive Kyle for what he's done to my family. And no, I can't forgive him. The thing that happens is one person, he thought he took two girls away from a family. But in fact, it's a chain reaction of events that occur after that. The friends of the girls, the family, it's just one thing leads to another. You know, your nights of lost sleep.
It demolishes the lives of how many people?
It's just endless. It's endless. Of course, their age, the girls' age, they had many friends at Kirkwood. And it's just, you don't realize, you hear from these kids as time passes along and you hear different things, how Katie came into this person's life and you never had a clue. Mm. That's just the way it was. But, you know, in Molly, you'll hear, our families will talk and we'll say that, you know, they'll hear something even years afterwards.
The person that took Shelley's life doesn't realize that on prom night, there's no one there to take pictures.
For the kids.
Or birthdays or whatever. So the family members step in. And the person that, for whatever reason he did, he will answer one day for that. But it impacts then, now, still, and forever, because, you know, Chelsea will have a prom night. Jacob will have a prom night. And there will be no mother there to see them, which would be Shelley's pride and joy.
What would life have been like, the lives of your families, you and your lives been like? Can you imagine this circumstance happening without the Survivors Program there? What would that have been like, Tammy?
Well, I felt that the Survivors Program gave us a vision, a light, something to look to tell us what we can expect in the next 20 minutes, what we can expect when we open the door, what we can expect when we need to park downtown. Just many, many things that you would never even think that you would have to worry about. I mean, when we go out here, we will help you. We will take you here. So, because when you open the door, there's media out there, or there's media in the courtroom filming, they know. And as a victim's family member, you have no idea.
Julie, for you and your family, without the Survivors Program?
I couldn't have imagined how to go through that. Right. I couldn't have imagined it. Honestly, I can't say enough about the support that BJ and Emily made me feel, and I know my family also, that this had just happened to us and that we were special and that they just worked for us. And I know that that's not the case, that they're there for everyone, but they just took us under their wing and they comforted us and they protected us.
Protection.
And they just made it safe for us. And if we wanted to go cry, they said, it's okay to go do that. You don't have to worry about it. It's okay. And you going through those first few months, you can't think straight. Your direction is so off. Your day is just so fogged and you're trying to think, and to have someone behind you, giving you that push and helping you in your direction, there's just no words that can say thank you enough.
BJ, we have just a couple minutes or a minute or so left of the program. I want to turn to you and have you talk a little bit about this program. What does it cost? this program in rough terms, and how is it supported?
We are funded through a grant from the Victims of Crime Act funding through the state of Iowa. And so that is how we're funded. We're funded about $65,000. We usually are running $30,000 in the hole from the moment we start. And, you know, we do get some private donations. In the past, we've gotten United Way donations that we haven't gotten those this year with the flooding. Our building actually got flooded, and so we are in a temporary location at this point. But that's how we do it. We get funded through the Victims of Crime Act funding.
For someone interested in finding more about the organization, Horizons and the Horizon Survivor Program, where would they go on the web?
Go to www.horizonsfamily.org, or you can contact me by email. It's bjfranklin@horizonsfamily.org.
Okay, I want to thank you all for being with us on this edition of The Exchange. Julie and Tammy, thank you so much for sharing that. And I know you're reaching out with your story so that there is increased awareness about this very valuable program. Unfortunately, we know other people will need this program. We want to make sure that program is there.
Definitely.
Julie, thank you very much. I'm very sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
And Tammy, likewise, I'm so sorry about your sister.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.